in Lahaina, Maui, Hawaii. She started grade school in Santa Maria, California, and finished sixth grade in Firkezadugu, Cote d'Ivoire in West Africa. Our son took first and second grade work in Africa and learned to read and write French before English. Both finished high school in Moses Lake, Washington, and went on to college, she to Wellesley and he to Harvard. In Africa, our two children are the only Caucasians in the village school. And since we were the only Latter-day Saint family in the country, for 2.5 years we held church services in our living room on the sugar plantation and sent our tithing to church headquarters through the International Mission. Sunday mornings, we invited neighboring Black and Creole children to attend our classes on the teachings of Christ. We formed a small plantation youth choir for Christmas, and I organized women into a prototype Relief Society for monthly cultural refinement lessons, without using the name, of course. This was the mid-1970s, before the revelation on priesthood going to all worthy males. Still, we answered questions from our Black neighbors about our church and Latter-day Saint family life, leaving them copies of the Book of Mormon in French. We lived then in one of the outposts of the church. 12 years later, in 1988, when we were called to open the Latter-day Saint mission to the Côte d'Ivoire, Barnard and I returned, remembering our friendships with African people and eager to share the gospel with them. I will never forget when Philippe Assard, a high priest and Black first counselor in the unit presidency, administered a blessing of health to Barnard. What a happy reversal of former roles, Black man blessing white man, made possible after decades of prayer by current revelation. Before we started our missionary service to Africa, Elder Alexander Morrison advised us to adopt 4 traits to avoid being taken advantage of ourselves and to keep us and our naivete from ruining the work. Be bold, courageous, adaptable, and shrewd, he said. After 8 months, because of security reasons, we received a transfer from Cote d'Ivoire to Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. In our first week in Kinshasa, we were stopped by a squad of soldiers who wanted our car, our money, and perhaps our lives. This was indeed a challenge to courage and shrewdness. When a soldier pulled up the door lock, several piled into the car. One grabbed my two-way radio. 2 others fought Barnard for the car keys, which he protected with a tight grip over the key in the ignition. They nearly strangled him as they fought for control. Another ransacked my purse looking for money. Miraculously, although the bills were there, the soldier who saw them once couldn't find them when he searched the second time. Of course, that may just be a tribute to a woman's confusing purse. The squad chief demanded we open the trunk of the car. Barnard would not until they radioed their commanding officer to come. Then we waited, resistant hostages, declaring we were American missionaries and would not turn the car over to them. During that wait, I recognized that on the Lord's errand, I had to be willing to give up my life if necessary. This might be the end. The soldiers could rough us up. They could detain us in one of their notorious jails. They could seize our cars and dump our bodies in the nearby Congo River. But I felt calm. After all, we were part of the sweep of history. If the Lord needed us to survive, he would help. I had committed to be in Africa despite discomfort and danger. And for what? For the joy of interacting with people in the core decisions of their lives, perhaps helping them change small pieces of their world as prompted by the Holy Ghost. When the local commander arrived a half hour later, his tone was much less aggressive than the local soldiers. He saw that we were not candidates for killing or for a big bribe. We opened the trunk of the car then and shared its treasures with the soldiers, pamphlets telling the Joseph Smith story in French. They gave us back the radio, my purse, and our freedom, and sent us on our way. I stay in the church because only this way of life seems real. It asks a lot of us, it offers benefits, and it meshes with my view of God and humankind. Four principles underlie my philosophy towards the church. One, from early days, I have felt a fulfilling inner spiritual life. God is my Father, He needs me to do His work. Although I follow my own reasoning and instincts, I often recognize divine direction. I also believe that God is serious. I cannot violate His order of things with impunity. I need to respect His institutions and called leaders, but I can talk to Him with candor. Two, the church provides a structure through which we work with others for social good, fellowship, and learning. Within this organization, my ambition has been not simply to follow church leaders, but to counsel with them, to benefit the church with my thinking and efforts. Serving on the General Board of the Relief Society in the 1990s provided an unusual chance to do this, not only with women leaders, but also on a limited scale with our advisors, the 70s and apostles. Three, I see this life through the lens of pragmatism and irony. All institutions in this world have flaws. My worldview envisions a Father in heaven with a sense of humor who gives us as much understanding as our human condition can make use of. He operates as we do in a world of choices where the contest between good and evil requires our participation. He lends His power and perspective, but the details are not predestined. Fourth, for me, membership in the church brings a life of zest. I value talking ideas with fellow believers, those acquainted with the terms and issues of Mormondom who feel what is genuinely at stake. I respect what our parents and ancestors have contributed. I'm presently trying to reconstruct the world and the social and spiritual milieu of earlier believing saints through the editing of the Emmeline V. Wells diaries. I'm impressed by the intensity of their commitment to the church under tremendous political and social pressures. Now, Barnard and I teach Sunday school at the Utah State Prison. We talk with men who are asking the ultimate questions of life. Among these, the marginalized, we find centrality of faith, hope, and even charity. We are grateful that the church provides strong programs in Family History Institute, music, values classes, and worship for seekers of truth in that prison. I affirm that we are all, whether living precariously on the outskirts or comfortably in the center of the church, part of a world of choice and contest, where an inner spiritual life, study and fellowship together in the gospel, hope in a Redeemer, provide purpose and zest as no other outlook that I know does. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to share this platform with many old friends. The term old is being used more and more these days, but Armin and I were doctoral students together at Berkeley a long time ago. Recently I was talking with an acquaintance who said that her mind told her to leave the church and her heart told her to stay. And she was engaged in a battle between her mind and her heart. I like Thomas Jefferson's debate between his head and his heart as he attempted to frame a world that was manageable and that was understandable and happy. The happy sometimes doesn't come. But the idea of the mind and the heart reminds me of a frame that I think is useful for my discussion today. In Matthew 22, when the Pharisees heard that Savior had put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together, and one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him, saying, "Master, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus said unto them, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Heart, mind, soul. Those three dimensions provide for me a frame for looking at this critical, difficult, and exciting question. Let me suggest that with the mind, heart, and soul, the intellectual, the emotion, the feeling, and the transcendent, inspirational components of who we are and how we function. Let me read a quote from a book I read recently by Frank Delaney entitled Ireland, a novel. Beneath all the histories of Ireland, there's always been another less obvious reporter speaking. The oral tradition, Ireland's vernacular narrative, telling the country's story to her people in tales handed down since God was a boy. The fireside voice took great care to say that imagination and emotion play their critical parts in history. And therefore, to understand the Irish, facts are never enough. This is a country that reprocesses itself through the mills of its creative imagination. But we all do that. We merge our myths and our facts according to our feelings. We tell ourselves our own story. And no matter what we're told, we choose to believe what we will believe. All truths are only our truths, because we bring to the facts our feelings, our experiences, our wishes, our dreams. Thus, storytelling, from whenever it comes, forms the critical layer in the foundation of the world. And glinting in it, we see the trace elements of every tribe on earth. My story is unique. It's not easily shared. I hedge at this challenge today, because much of my story is very private. And much of my story is very conflicted. And much of my story is very paradoxical. And much of my story is different today than it was yesterday. Stories are idiosyncratic. I would hope that all might be true to their story. But I would also hope that we could tell an authentic story. The challenge that I faced when I was chairing the board of Sunstone, when the famous statement came out about symposium, unauthorized. I go to thousands of unauthorized symposiums, but this was just one more. When that pronouncement came out, it provided a wonderful opportunity for dialogue, for discourse, for debate, for arguments. At that time, I was chairing the Organization Behavior Department at BYU. I was chairing the Utah State Liquor Commission, and I was chairing the board of Sunstone. Some people saw conflicts. Some people saw tension. I saw opportunity. I saw fun. We're also very good at self-deception, and therefore sometimes our stories are a facade to cover something. That's why the quest for an authentic story is so difficult. And as I responded to Elder Oaks at that time, I said, I don't perceive mine as an alternative voice. I see mine as an honest voice. And there's a crying need for honest voices. I don't claim that I always attain that honesty, but I try. I don't claim that I'm always accurate in my assessment of emotion or feeling or intellectual position or inspiration, but I try. And in that same sense, I would hope we would all try. And in that process, we'll make some mistakes. I'm reassured by quotes from one of my favorite general authorities, Hugh B. Brown, who said that I'm grateful in this church for the diversity that we have, the dignity, integrity of the individual, democracy, where we're free to express our opinion and to think whatever we will. Only error needs fear, freedom of expression. I'm excerpting from a long talk. We must preserve freedom of the mind at all costs and resist all efforts to suppress it. The church is not concerned with whether our thoughts are orthodox or heterodox, as they are that we have thoughts. One may memorize much without learning. In this age of speed, there's little time for meditation. And while all members should respect, support, and heed teachings of the authorities, no one should accept a statement and bear his or her testimony upon it, base his or her testimony upon it, no matter who makes it, until he or she has, under mature examination, found it to be true for them. Only then can one's logical deduction be confirmed by the Spirit. And so as we struggle to debate and to understand and to make decision, reflection. Reflection is difficult, but critical. 10 years ago, Dave Ulrich and I wrote an article in Sunstone entitled, Why I Like Being a Mormon. This article led to Dave's call as a mission president. And we referenced a perspective that we have attempted to define. A friend recently overheard us casually discussing our observations about the church, lack of spirit in many contexts, the tendency of many leaders to exercise unrighteous dominion by imposing their personal, political, social, or theological biases, policies that run counter to what we like, policies that limit rather than encourage honest dialogue, insidious process of judging by labeling right-wing, liberal, feminist, intellectual, etc. The insensitivity of many to the feelings of those who feel alienated and estranged, and so forth and so on. It's a long article. I won't read it all. But this individual said, how can you remain in the church? And as we thought about it, we said, we like being Mormon. Said why. And we referenced Andrew Greeley's fun account of his interview with Phil Donahue. Now, Father Greeley, Phil Donahue said, this is quoting from Andrew Greeley, don't you think it would be better if all dissenting Catholics simply left the Catholic Church? Wouldn't it be better that if only those who agreed with the Pope remained? And Andrew Greeley said, but who would pay the light bills? And Phil Donahue said, shouldn't all Catholics agree with the Pope on all issues? Birth control, celibacy, abortion, women? Why should I leave? I asked Phil. Because you can't be a good Catholic unless you agree with everything. I won't stop being a Catholic until I formally renounce, walk, and join another denomination. Why don't I leave? Because I like being a Catholic. He Donahue threw up his hands. What does that have to do with it? Everything, I said. I also like Joseph F. Smith's line where he said, the difficulty is not in getting Latter-day Saints to conform. The difficulty is getting them to understand, to think. In that process of thinking and understanding, let me suggest a few idiosyncratic dimensions that not only allow, but that make it exciting for me to stay. Dealing with the mind, I love the richness of the theology. I get great fun in debates. I grew up reading John A. Widsell, Evidences and Reconciliations, Rational Theology, Talmage, Adam S. Bunyan, B.H. Roberts. People that challenged Lowell Bunyan, clearly, as was mentioned, clearly, people that challenged a way of thinking that defined religion in the pursuit of truth by Lowell Bunyan. The richness of those debates I find exciting. Every positive also has a negative. Those theological debates can turn into things equivalent to how many angels condense on the head of a pin, as is true in many sacrament meetings I go to, many Sunday school classes and priesthood classes, and many Sunstone sessions where irrelevancy and cleverness overpower meaning and substance. But I do like the debate on issues that for me are important. And all issues are not important for me, and some are not important for you, but some are. And I want a venue, a context, where I can debate those issues. And in my experience, the church is one of the fun ones to do that. But with that will come disagreement. A few years ago, I was teaching a class in conflict resolution for the Jordanian Institute of Diplomacy. As many of you know, my wife and I have lived in Jordan or Jerusalem or Beirut or Cairo for about six of the last dozen years. And actually, I would feel much more comfortable today explaining the motivation and strategy of Hezbollah and of Hamas than I am describing my own value system. I've spent a professional lifetime observing, analyzing, describing, critiquing organizations. And I'm much more comfortable with those outside than I am inside. But in that process, I love conflict. One of my students, one of the equivalent of a State Department employee in Jordan, said at the end of one of our class periods, he says, gee, he said, you would make a really good Arab. I said, why? He says, because you thrive on conflict. I've also had that said in Jerusalem by a rabbi with respect to Judaism, and by a feisty Catholic nun, administrator of a hospital, with respect to my appropriateness for being a Jesuit. So a rabbi, an Arab, a Jesuit. But I love the give and take. I agree with Joseph Smith that by proving contrary, truth is made manifest. By the debate, by the intellectual honesty, by the process by which we push assumptions, we find truth. And I thrive. I don't like all conflict. I like constructive conflict. Destructive conflict I can do without. I like Bishop Woolley's response when confronted by Brigham Young, which was a frequent, according to Leonard Arrington, a frequent event. Bishop Edwin Woolley, who was, of course, the grandfather of President Kimball, was the bishop of the 13th Ward when there were 19 wards in Salt Lake, and the 13th Ward was kind of the center ward of the 19. Bishop Woolley was the administrator of Brigham Young's private estate and property and interests. as well as Bishop of the Warden. And he was fairly independent. He would organize excursions. He would build schools and cultural halls before they were appropriate. And Brigham Young one time chastised him for taking action that was unauthorized, and in fact, Brigham Young overrode him. And then Brigham Young came back to him and said, "Now, Bishop Woolley, I suppose you're going to leave the church over my chastisement and over my decision." And Bishop Woolley looked at him and said, "No, Brigham," he says, "this is just as much my church as it is yours, and I'm not going to leave because you make a dumb decision." Well, that reference was provided for me by Ed Kimball. I like it. Ed claims, and I admit that it's probably been embellished somewhat over the years, but there's no question of the debate and the respect and Brigham Young's affection for Bishop Woolley, because he was one of the few people that was honest, that expressed honest feelings. I don't assume organizations are perfect. The idea of the church being a perfect organization is very troublesome to me, as it was compared to the Prussian army. I found very offensive even as a child. All organizations are immoral, some much more than others. But I've made a lifetime of studying that process, and the Doctrine and Covenants help explain it. We've learned by sad experience it's the nature and disposition of almost all. As soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, kind of a cynical little phrase that God or Joseph Smith added, as soon as they suppose to exercise unrighteous dominion. All organizations are subject to the idiosyncratic behavior of people, and those people will exercise unrighteous dominion, and when it happens, people suffer. And therefore, in every organizational setting, almost all doesn't leave a lot of room. You know, every organization, there's that process. How do we juggle it? How do we manage it? E.F. Schumacher says that the sign of the mature person is the ability to hold two opposing opinions in your mind at the same time. There are a lot of opposing opinions that I have. I'm not comfortable with much of the Old Testament. I'm not comfortable with much of the Book of Mormon. I'm not comfortable with many policies and many procedures. But I make decisions on balance. I'm on the margin. And on a 1 to 10 scale, the line is between 5 and 6. And some of us are fives and some are sixes. The one is the true believer, and the 10 is the total enemy. Five is barely in and six is barely out. And all organizations have a lot of good and a lot of bad. All don't have a lot of good. Many do. And so you make the decision. You make two fundamental decisions. One is a decision to be in or out, and the other is a decision as to degree of participation. And the decision in or out is five or six. And then you decide one, two, or three, or eight, nine, or 10, depending on 1,000 variables that are operating. I make decisions on the margin, and on the margin, it feels good to be in the church. But there are a lot of things I don't do and I'm not going to do. Clark Kerr, when he was president of the University of California, said that we can never make the university safe for students. We can only make students safe for the university. We can never make organizations safe for people. We can only make people safe for organizations, because organizations will always abuse and exploit in some way, or people will use the organization to do so. I accept that, and I'm very happy to say that I want to make the organization more effective, more honest, and more appropriate for more people, even though I think there's a lot of room for tension. All organizations tend to have a conservative convergence for their own survival, but it also is the means of their destruction. In order for them to survive, there needs to be a liberal tension in that organization of change. And any good leader is both a liberal and a conservative. Liberal in terms of changing that which needs to be changed, and a conservative in terms of conserving those things which should be conserved. The discussion as to which is the tension that is so real. Many of you have heard me cite the experience when I was interviewed to come to BYU. My friends didn't think I could stand BYU, and my enemies didn't think BYU could stand me. but I came, and I was interviewed by Bruce R. McConkie, and he asked me if I was a liberal. And I said, well, I consider myself, I was a left-wing liberal at Berkeley as a student. And I was only arrested once and spent some time in jail and been shot at several times in civil rights demonstrations with Martin Luther King and in the marching of Palestinians in the West Bank. And I think I'm an activist of some sort, although I'm sort of old and tired now, but I've done enough of that. And I said, I consider myself, but I'd like to know your definition before I answer the question. He said, well, a liberal is somebody who doesn't believe that Jesus was really the Son of God, or that Joseph Smith was a prophet, or that the Book of Mormon is scripture. I said, gee, that's useful to have that definition before I answer. I said, because that's not my definition. And that's not my perspective, and so we need more communication. I said, and by the way, you know, why do you have your hair cut short? He had a crew cut in those days. So everybody else I know has long hair. Even David O. McKay, president of the church, has long hair. And you've got a crew cut. I said, that's the symbol of a Nazi. So you say, liberal, you know, you look like a Nazi to me. He laughed, and a year later, when I saw him in an apartment where my daughter was living in Salt Lake, he'd let his hair grow and said, see, I'm not a Nazi anymore. The process of confronting and working through and resolving issues. One last example. I recall a famous encounter. Most of you won't remember, but in the late 60s, had a Democratic Congress that was trying to repeal Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act. And this was a very controversial issue that allowed states to override federal law with respect to a right to work vote. And the momentum was gathering for repeal. A letter went out over the signature of the first presidency to all LDS Congress, members of Congress and many others, advising against repeal. Letters came from several U.S. LDS Congress, members of Congress, including Mo Udall from Arizona, who said he intended to vote against repeal, but he didn't want anyone, his constituents, his colleagues, and especially the church, to think that their letter had any influence on his vote. And he resented the fact that they sent it because it implied a very insidious process. Ken Dial, LDS liberal representative from California, was defeated over this issue. A few weeks later, there was a classic interview in the New York Times with Hubie Brown, where he said, you know, we made a bad mistake. And this was a decision that went out over the signature of the first presidency, of which he was one. He says, we made a bad mistake. He says, I didn't think through the issue. He said, we were wrong. Several Congress, members of Congress and members of the church wrote to tell us where to go, and they had every right to do so. Are you free to be a creative, committed Mormon? That's a fun question and a difficult one. I hope that we all are, that on the margin we make decisions that are difficult, realize that no organization is perfect, the expectation gap is real. If you demand all or nothing, you're doomed to a life of frustration. If you can live on the margin, it's an exciting and fun and stimulating world to be part of. I hope that all of us can be part of that process. Thank you.
You can see why it's intimidating to be on this panel. It's also a deep honor, and I appreciate the invitation. The first question I asked myself was, why am I here? Why am I on this panel? And the second question was, why do I stay in the LDS Church? And I want you to know that the answer is sitting here and in this room. I can't tell you what Sunstone and Dialogue and these publications and people like this have meant to me to keep me secure in the faith. Ever since Brother Pingree called me about the invitation, I've been thinking a great deal and trying to define an answer to this question, why I stay, and I've come up with several answers which I'll share with you, but I want to divide them into three little areas. One, where did I come from? Two, where have I been? And three, where am I going? In answer to the first, let me quote from Levi Peterson's new autobiography on page 9, where he writes, quote, "My ancestors help explain me. With a few exceptions, all of my known ancestors had an instinct for believing, suffering, sacrificing for a quaint, controversial religion. And for that reason, I am, emotionally speaking, an indelible Mormon." This is on, end of quote, this is on page 9 of his autobiography. "I have the usual folk tales of pioneer ancestors. My great-grandmother, Rebecca Winters, died on the plains and is buried there. I could tell many stories about that. I grew up in a very Orthodox Mormon home with 8 sisters and no brothers, and this has made a difference in my life because I grew up in a family of very verbal, opinionated, and expletive women, and we all speak our minds very clearly. My father always wanted a son, but he didn't get one, but he treated us as if we were sons. We had a great deal of freedom and choice in our home. It was a home where questions were not only allowed, but were encouraged on every subject you could think of. My mother was a very intelligent, widely read, and thoughtful person who lived her testimony of the gospel every day in the decisions that she made, and often would verbally bear it to us. Our father was a successful trial attorney, a deeply religious scholar who studied church history throughout his intense most life. His ability and propensity to ask questions sometime brought him to the attention of the brethren. And I could tell you some wonderful stories about that. But he was a doubter, like Thomas, and he was not afraid to ask the questions that no one else would ask, always hoping to find the answers. One of his favorite quotations was a statement by Robert Weston, who said, quote, "Cherish your doubts, for doubt is the attendant of truth. Doubt is the secret of discovery and the key to the door of knowledge. A belief which cannot be questioned binds us to error, for there is incompleteness and imperfection in every belief. Truth stands boldly and unafraid. It is not afraid of the testing. It rises again from each testing, stronger and more secure. Those who silence doubt are full of fear. Their houses are built on sand. Those who fear not doubt and know all its uses are founded on a rock." Our father's testimony was founded on a rock. We attended primary, Sunday school, MIA, all graduated from seminary. We observed the word of wisdom in our home, and we all were, each were married in the temple. We didn't go on missions because my father didn't believe it was appropriate for young women to serve on missions. I have served in 2 Relief Society presidencies in different areas, and for 50 years, I had the pleasure of teaching the Relief Society lessons. And I can tell you, I grieve for where they have gone. But they were a tremendously rich blessing in my life. Now, my second question, where have I been? Well, I won't tell you how many countries we've lived in, but I can assure you it's Turkey, Italy, Spain, Germany 3 times, England 3 times. We've lived in many places. But and they have all influenced me in my spirituality and my religion. We don't have time to talk about that. After a year as a freshman at BYU, I decided to go into nurses training. My father, in his usual way, investigated all the nursing programs in the state of Utah, and he made the decision that the Catholic Hospital, Holy Cross Hospital, had the most intense and impressive nursing program. So I enrolled at Holy Cross, and I stayed there for 3 years in a wonderful program. I attended prayers every morning at 6:30 in the chapel. I attended Mass 2 or 3 times a week, and I lived with the sisters, those blessed nuns, for 3 years. All of these experiences enriched my life in immeasurable ways, but most significantly, they enriched my religious and spiritual life. One of the first things there that I was impressed with was the beauty of the architect and the decor of the chapel at Holy Cross and at the Cathedral of the Madeleine, which we attended many times. The stained glass windows, the liturgy, the statues of significant people, all said to me, "This is a sacred place. Worship thou me." I contrasted it to the Provo Fifth Ward, and I will tell you that this is the replica of the Provo Fifth Ward Chapel. Now, look around. What is there in this room that says to you, "This is a holy place, worship thou me"? Nothing. Well, I've enjoyed every cathedral and every beautiful church we've been in all over the world because of that reason. It was important to me to learn the Stations of the Cross and all of the other, the Mass and the Rosary, and it has enhanced my understanding and appreciation of much of the great music of the world. Famous composers, the finest music in the world has been written to accompany the Mass. So if you know when they're playing in the Kyrie that it's saying, "God have mercy, Christ have mercy," or you know that when they play the Agnus Dei, they're saying the Lamb of God. And the same with the Gloria and the Sanctus. Preparing for this speech, I'm reminded of a letter that my husband and I wrote. We write many letters to general authorities and politicians and all kinds of people. This was a letter we wrote 6 or 7 years ago to Elder Dallin Oaks. We were concerned about all the literature that we would read in the newspapers that said Mormons aren't Christian. And this explains a little bit of why we perceive that this is such a widespread concept. So I'm just going to read you 2 short paragraphs. A number of years ago, we wrote a book about family home evening activities, which was published by Bookcraft. We had a chapter on observing the 4 Advent Sundays for Christmas, emphasizing that this was a way to prepare the heart for Christmas. Bookcraft asked us to remove that chapter on the Advent as being inappropriate for Mormon readers. Now, our family has observed Advent for over 50 years, and for many years we would invite family and friends to come and participate with us, and it became a bigger and bigger occasion. And for the last 25 years, we have observed Advent at the Provo Community Church, and we now call it Carols by Candlelight, and it is always attended by 250 or 300 people. It has been, now Advent has been observed by the Christian community since the 4th century. Why isn't it observed by Mormons? Why is it considered inappropriate? The second paragraph has to do with another thing. It's significant feature of Christianity is the reverent significance of the cross. I've never seen it in a Mormon building of any kind. It makes most Mormons paranoia or very apprehensive. Let me just explain. I have meant to bring it this morning and I forgot. I have a beautiful rosary that was given, that was sent to my mother in the 1920s by her uncle, Wilford Booth, who was serving a mission in Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and the Middle East, Turkey, and other places. She treasured it, but before she died, she gave it to me. And I treasure it, and on occasion, I will wear it. One day when I was wearing this rosary, the daughter of a member of the First Presidency of the Church came up to me, yanked the rosary from my neck, and said, "Why are you wearing that thing?" That thing is the Holy Cross, the universal symbol of Christ's suffering and sacrifice. Why does it make so many Mormons anxious and uncomfortable? Now, if I can find my place with that diversion. Now, time doesn't allow me to talk about the role of women in the church, but I have very deep feelings about what's happened to our Relief Society. I've taught in the Relief Society and worked there for all of my adult life. But they took away first the magazine, and then they took away the budget, and then they took away the lessons. The Relief Society lessons were taught by brilliant, articulate women, scholarly women. But now they're written by men, and they are about men. So when I went to get my recent temple recommend, my state president said to me, "Do you attend all your meetings?" And I said, "I don't go to Relief Society." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because there's nothing there for women. This is an organization of men." Well, I won't go into that in any detail, but I keep asking myself, why haven't the women, well, this symposium answers that question, why haven't the women had the courage to speak up and say, this isn't what we desire? And so I begin to think about where those women are. And Molly Bennion has written a glorious article in the new, hold up the dialogue, Molly, the new dialogue on lament. I want all of you to read Molly's article because she's asking the same question. Where have these women gone? I think to myself, among the 80 general authorities, isn't there one wife of any of those men that ever says, "Why are you doing this to women? Where are these women?" Do you know what I call them? The Stepford wives. Now, if you remember that story, those Stepford wives who were rebellious all had part of their brains removed, so they would become the domestic creatures that their husband wanted them to be. Well, I don't mean to be totally irreverent. But there are a lot of questions that we need to have answered. In a recent report of the conference on Joseph Smith held at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., Dr. Richard Bushman reported that the consensus of the scholars speaking there, both Mormon and non-Mormon, was that there were two things about Mormons that were critical. One was they're too defensive about their religion. I should say we're too defensive about our religion. And the second is that we don't know enough about other religions and other denominations. My experience is that many of us don't want to know, and we don't have time. I could tell you some marvelous stories about introducing people to speakers, but they don't want to hear it. We invited Carrie Galloway, who's a very dear friend, head of Utah Planned Parenthood, to come to our home and speak. Well, and when I called people to invite them, the response was, with almost everyone, "But we don't believe in that." So we don't want to, they don't want to be informed either as to what it really is. Now the second part of Dr. Bushman's statement will let me tell you a little bit about experiences of living under other places in the world. And certainly Cherry has covered that very beautifully. But we were living in Turkey, And I realized, as I'm sure she did in Africa and other places, I know nothing about Islam. I know nothing about the Muslim faith. So the very first thing I did was get the life of Muhammad. And I read it through. And I was surprised to find that the life of Muhammad was so parallel in so many ways with the life of Joseph Smith. Now, Joseph Taranto, a professor at the BYU, has written beautifully about this in an Ensign article where he pointed out the similarities of Muhammad's experience and the similarity of Joseph Smith's experiences were identical. I found 26 ways in where they were exactly the same. So I concluded, God works with his prophets the same way, whether it's in the 6th century or whether it's in the 19th century, when he's giving them directions and inspiration. Not only did I read the life of Muhammad, but I read the Quran. I've read the Quran several times. Last year I finished reading the Book of Mormon again because President Hinckley told us to read the Book of Mormon. So when I finished reading the Book of Mormon, I read the Quran again. And I have read the Upanishads, I have read the Vedas. And the most impressive thing about this is that they're all similar. These religions all want the same things, a good, well-lived life for their members. We have the Ten Commandments. They have the five points of spirituality. Every one of them reiterate the same things. They shall not kill, they shall not lie, they shall love their neighbor. So why do we live in a world where everyone is at loggerheads with every other religion? And I've appreciated the wonderful things that these previous speakers have said. Now onto the question about why I stay. I stay because being a Mormon is my life. It's my milieu. It has defined me, my behavior, my relationships with my family and other human beings, and it defines my relationship to God. What kind of a God do I believe in? A caring, loving God who is present and there. Mormonism has defined my life for 87 years. Of course, at 87, I know all the answers, but nobody ever asked me a question. I stay because of the Articles of Faith and what the dimension they give us in when the 8th Article of Faith that said, we believe the Bible to be the Word of God as far as it is translated correctly. What a wonderful thing that gives us in this present day when all those old scriptures are being discovered, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Gnostic Gospels, the latest, the Gospel of Jesus. We're not bound by every word and punctuation in the Bible as being the literal Word of God. I love that expansiveness. To me, my Mormonism is a very highly personal affair. When I am concerned about my loved ones, when I am troubled and afraid, when I sing the hymns of my childhood, God seems very comforting and present to me. My beliefs are to me rational, logical, and sustaining. I stay in the church because of the organization. One reason, the organization. I wish we had, well, you're aware of the incredible things that our church is doing all over the world. We have a son on a mission with his wife on a humanitarian mission in South America. I wish I could tell you what the church allows them to do. Hospitals, schools, villages. You know the story about the 1,000 wheelchairs that the church sent. They sent 1,000 wheelchairs to South America. David and Catherine were assigned to distribute the wheelchairs. They went into every little village, every little byway, and anyone who had been bedfast for 20 years now has a wheelchair and is mobile. They go to hospitals and take tremendous supplies to help them. Well, We don't have time to talk about those things, but those are the reasons why I stay a Mormon. Now, next week I may become an Episcopalian. But right now, I am a dedicated, believing, sincere Mormon.
Why I stay? In some ways, I find the question before us very peculiar. No one ever asks me why I stay with my family or with my nation, both of which connections are periodically stressful and no less voluntary than my relationship with the church. The question that brings us together in this session is itself, I suppose, a sign of the times. For it implicitly raises a question only slightly different. Why should we stay as members of the LDS Church, especially as actively participating members? From the perspective of a lifelong church member, I find the very question both revealing and troubling. It is revealing that such a question should be the main focus for a session of a Sunstone Symposium, for it suggests how salient and perhaps how pervasive this question is among an entire recent generation of church members. That it might be so salient is also very troubling, for it is indicative of a failure of the church, perhaps on a large scale, to provide enough answers to the implicit question, why should we stay? Despite half a century in which more American Latter-day Saints than ever before have grown up with seminary, institute, and a BYU education. For me, having grown up in California during the early days of the Mormon diaspora, I had access to none of these programs of education and indoctrination. And yet, I have stayed. Indeed, I have never contemplated leaving. Why not? Perhaps only because I'm a stubborn old man unwilling to concede that I could have been wrong all these years. Yet I think there is more to be said. Like our late beloved colleague Eugene England, I distinguish between the gospel and the church. And like Gene, I reject the cliche that it is the gospel and not the church which is truly important. I love the gospel, insofar as I can understand it, which I'm able to do only very incompletely. I would continue trying, however inadequately, to abide by gospel teachings, whether or not I stayed in the church, a position that is apparently shared by a number of my friends and colleagues who no longer go to church. My acceptance of the gospel of Jesus Christ, as taught in the Latter-day Saint tradition, is a matter of choice, not empirical certainty. Like many others, whether or not reared in the LDS tradition, I have my doubts. I always have, and I imagine that I always will. Doubt is the inevitable companion of deep and meaningful thought. I make no apologies either for the doubts or for choosing to believe in spite of them. Contrary to what many skeptics and atheists claim, it is common, if not universal, for human beings to hold ardently and permanently to beliefs and assumptions that are never empirically tested, or indeed can never be. In the jargon of science, these beliefs and assumptions are unfalsifiable. Nor are they all religious in nature. Freudian psychology generally, psychoanalysis in particular, are based on unfalsifiable assumptions about the human psyche that cannot be tested, even though they are widely applied in therapy. Similarly, predictions of any kind about the future cannot be tested or falsified ahead of time, but must be taken on faith, whether the future in question is in the next world, or in the nation's economy, or in the physical environment of this world. My own unfalsifiable beliefs and assumptions are therefore as valid as the next person's, but they are mine. Yet much in the gospel, as in the secular world, is subject to the test of experience, at least on an individual basis, if not always replicable in universal experience. As I am rapidly reaching the end of 8 decades of mortal life, my experience has taught me the wisdom of trying to live by gospel principles in lessons learned partly, I must confess, through the setbacks and unhappiness that I have periodically experienced and caused others during those times in my life when I have ignored or resisted gospel teachings. I continue to be intrigued by the innovative teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. Of course, there are some doctrines and practices that I don't understand very well, but I do not experience these as nagging doubts or problems, but as challenges. I've come to understand that living indefinitely with ambiguity is a sign of intellectual maturity, not weakness. For example, I don't understand how the atonement of the Savior works. I don't worry much about that, however, since the only thing I need to understand in this life is that the atonement works for me only to the extent that I try to live in a constant condition of repentance. Otherwise, it has no efficacy for me, no matter how well I understand it. And learning to repent as we go along is a good policy for all of us, no matter what its theological rationale. Similarly, there's a lot about the efficacy of temple work and genealogy that I find difficult to assimilate. Yet the eternal efficacy of temple marriage, for example, seems more likely if the parties at least have made a formal covenant for eternity than if they are married explicitly only for this life, which is the usual case outside the LDS temple. Vicarious work too, whatever its eternal significance might turn out to be, seems at least to foster family bonds in the here and now, or to turn the hearts of the fathers and children toward each other, as the scripture says. So I do my family history research and take my turn at temple assignments whenever they come along. Now, my outlook on the church is a different matter entirely from my religious beliefs, however well these might be rationalized, and maybe even more important than my beliefs. My perspective on the church and my understanding of its history and operation derive from academic study as well as from experience. And here I have parallel studies and experiences with Bonner. After earning degrees in history early in my career, I discovered the discipline of sociology, which has provided me with the kind of detached scholarly perspective necessary to understand and appreciate the church as an essentially human institution. As a matter of personal belief, I am convinced that Joseph Smith had a number of encounters with deity and with the supernatural. I don't necessarily subscribe to the official historical accounts of those encounters, but because of them, I attribute a divine origin to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. At the same time, my sociological perspective and study have convinced me that the church, whatever its origins, is not immune to the human processes and natural historical developments common to all social institutions. In other words, despite its divine origin, the church has, throughout its history, functioned mainly as a human institution, with divine intervention difficult to ascertain with any certainty, and probably very rare. I have found this perspective enormously helpful to my attitude toward the church and to my emotional well-being generally. Since I expect the church usually to operate as a human institution and its leaders as human beings, I am occasionally disappointed but never disillusioned. The admonition, follow the prophet, heard with increasing frequency in the church during my lifetime, is wise counsel, which I accept as a general rule. Yet too often, it is transformed into a ritualistic slogan or mantra intended to stifle questions and differences of opinion, or else to override the agency of a church member seeking the direct counsel of the Holy Spirit for his or her individual issues and circumstances. The related folk maxim that obedience is the first law of heaven does not accord with a reasonable reading of the scriptural account of the great war in heaven, where clearly agency was established as prior to obedience among the laws on which the plan of salvation is based. When such slogans and maxims are employed for leverage by overzealous leaders, contrary to the counsel about unrighteous dominion in Doctrine and Covenants 121, then the church is simply operating like any other human institution, and it is entitled only to the same presumption of loyalty that we give to other human institutions. I have often wrestled with my conscience on such occasions in trying to decide what obedience requires in specific cases, including political controversies. Yet I have never, at least in my adult life, been disillusioned by church leaders' counsel with which I have disagreed, or even by the most outrageous examples of unrighteous dominion. My understanding of human institutions and how they work has thus provided me with a kind of immunity to disillusionment. This is not to say that I don't care about how the church operates or what happens to it. My sociological detachment does not extend that far. If the church is a human institution, though, I would like to see it also a bit more humane. If the church has divine origins and a divine mandate to bless the world through its priesthood ordinances, as I believe it has, then I would like to see it grow and prosper and to do a much better job at retaining its members indefinitely rather than only until they become disillusioned or until they no longer see the missionaries who once converted them. If the church is the most important repository of truth on the earth, then I would like to see more candor and transparency about the facts as well as the truths in our own doctrine and history, and less defensiveness about the anomalies revealed thereby, even when they are embarrassing. The church cannot prosper and retain the loyalty of its members if they come through its religious education programs unduly sheltered from the controversies in our history and doctrine. For sooner or later, their ignorance will make them vulnerable to the recurrent one-sided anti-Mormon propaganda charge that they have simply been lied to. One of the reasons, then, that I stay in the church is the belief that I can contribute to the mitigation of these kinds of systemic problems, in our Mormon family. I hasten to add that I do not think of myself as any kind of reformer. That is not my job. I am, however, a reasonably well-informed observer with a certain amount of expertise in how organizations can work best toward the achievement of their most important goals. I often make my observations and analyses publicly and in print for whatever they might be worth, without any attempt to counsel the brethren or to criticize them for any inadequacies that I see. I know that some of them listen to me and read what I write, which they might not do if I were just another disillusioned and critical carper. Another reason I stay is focused at a more local and individual level. My ward provides me with a ready-made community in which I can use whatever talents and wisdom I have to help others, whether that takes programmatic forms like teaching classes, running quorums, or home teaching, or whether it takes less formal extensions, whether it takes the form of less formal extensions of assistance, friendship, or counsel. Reciprocally, I know that outside of my immediate family, my ward community cares more about me and my wife than does any similar collection of people on earth. Not that all is sweetness and light. In every ward in which I have lived, there have been some members whom I did not like or respect very much, and some bishops who I thought were both pompous and ineffective. Of course, I'm pretty sure that I rub a lot of people the wrong way much of the time as well. Yet, as Jean England has taught us, that is precisely why the church is as true as the gospel. If we can't overcome ill feelings toward others and learn to love all of God's children through our relationships in the church, then, for heaven's sake, where on earth will we learn to live the gospel of love? So why do I stay in the church? Why wouldn't I?
I stay because I was born into a Protestant family and raised Lutheran. Had I been born in the covenant, I might not be in the church today. Not long ago, a friend asked me if I would join the church while learning about it for the first time. Possibly not. But if I did, it would be as much because of what I know outside of Mormonism as what I know of Mormonism. My parents were Lutheran and Scotch Presbyterian with Greek and Emersonian overlay. My father did not attend church through my youth. He read philosophy and poetry to me to balance Lutheran catechism classes. "To thine own self be true" is his mantra. My grandfather, Alexander McClellan, emigrated from Scotland. As a child, I wore a pin, a crest with the McClellan motto, "Think on." To my father, few sins are greater than letting someone else do your thinking for you. He taught me to study hard and to humbly recognize my dependence on the research and thought of others, but never to abdicate the responsibility to weigh the evidence for myself. I stay as I watch some of my friends go. They go for many complaints I share. Some dislike policies and leadership. The deceitful campaign to defeat the ERA, attempts to prohibit real scholarship of church history, sneaky forays into gay marriage politics, sour bishops, and excommunications of members I know to be faithful disappoint me too. Some leave for the lack of female role models and the need of evidence that women's input is considered at every level of decision making. Some leave out of boredom. Some need a community more engaged in spiritual seeking and finding. Those sense a spiritual malaise in our ranks. Some leave because they're offended. As they leave, I feel left and lonely. I miss them. I wrote in the summer issue of Dialogue that church is the loneliest place I regularly go. A number of people wrote to me offering their friendship and expressing their concern for me. I was really touched. But my loneliness is confined to church, and mostly church meetings. Most of my close Mormon friends are not in my ward or stake. They never have been. Many friends are not LDS. I'm always looking for good friends at church, and this year I've found one, but it's rare. Most of the social activities, frankly, bore me too, or they conflict with activities I'd rather do and find more worthy. Church classes usually bore me even more. As I said in my Dialogue lament, the boredom of church is more than mind-numbing and exhausting. I come to church hoping to be refreshed and invigorated, healed from the wounds of 1 week, and energized to face the challenges of the next. Instead, I often leave weary, frustrated, demoralized, and hungry, both intellectually and spiritually. Few members show any interest in the intellectual and spiritual questions with which I wrestle. Reading an inspiring book on a quiet Sunday evening at the end of my dock, enveloped in a glorious sky, pulling my spirit upward, is far more nourishing than most church meetings. I've become rather picky in what I will and will not do in church service. I will do anything to serve meaningfully. I will not attend useless make-work meetings. I reached 60 this year, and I feel such impatience to learn and serve while I still can. My father's once photographic memory is crippled with dementia. Will I be next? When? I've wasted enough time already. There's simply no time left to waste. So, if it's all that bad, why do I stay? I stay because what I believe and of what I do not believe. I stay because the gospel principles I took years to consider still seem true, and I stay because I have had a few confirming spiritual experiences. What others believe and do around me is almost irrelevant. To explain, I return to my upbringing. My parents' addition of the humanists to the Lutherans and the Presbyterians softened the blow of man is a mess with man is a work in progress. I have never expected religious leaders to be more than men, often inspired to do fine deeds, but often left to do very human ones. They are sometimes noble and sometimes a mess, but always, like us, works in progress. Even scriptures they produce are far from a mess, but nevertheless touched by the flawed hand of man and logically imperfect also. I am sometimes disappointed by leaders, but like Armand, I am never disillusioned. And I didn't have to get to this point by lowering my expectations. They have always been mercifully low. I ever hope for the finest examples of goodness in my leaders, but I'm not derailed by those that fall short. Sexism, racism, greed, pettiness, power-grabbing politics, all infect organizations, religious and otherwise. The God in whom I believe is much less involved in every word and deed of our leaders than some claim. Unfortunately, he's also much less involved in my life than I would like. He could save me from many an error, but he doesn't. He seems rather uninvolved in human life. I often feel, as did the author of Lamentations, you, God, have covered yourself with a cloud so that prayer should not pass through. But I certainly don't see any other belief system in which he's more involved. We ask, like the psalmist, rouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O Lord? Perhaps he's busy with more important concerns. Perhaps he wants to see how we'll ride without training wheels. But whatever the reasons, I think he inspires on occasion, rarely, very rarely, but doesn't control. I stay because I believe in the basic tenets of the gospel as taught by the LDS Church. I believe in God. I've read the agnostic and atheistic theories. I must need to believe. I can't face life without eternal meaning. Spiritual experiences are neurological. Perhaps. I can't prove the existence of God to one of my sons, let alone to you. Neither can an unbeliever disprove the existence of God for lack of scientific evidence. To say that all reality is understandable and explicable seems to me narrow and arrogant. We know so little of the workings of the brain and of the metaphysical, or for that matter, of everything else, that I can't conclude that what we understand today defines the whole of truth, or even the means to acquire that truth. Rather skeptical and rational being that I think I am, I still cannot explain several personal spiritual experiences, too personal to share and too real to deny. Furthermore, I can't deny or prove, of course, the spiritual experiences of others I trust. So I cannot relegate them to the dustbin of need and neurological response, and I must leave open the possibility of divine existence. Most importantly, I find rationality, order, and goodness in the gospel message. At the risk of further personalizing the anthropomorphic Mormon God, if I were to design a gospel, I hope it would closely resemble ours. I believe in eternal progression. I believe in individual responsibility and life as a test without a great deal of divine intervention. I believe in a God confined by principles and conditions which preceded him, notably the existence of evil. I could not believe in a God who created evil. I do not believe in original sin. I do not understand the atonement, though I have accepted tentative theories which satisfy me for the time. I believe in the equality of mankind in the eyes of God. The theory of a literal brotherhood and sisterhood is immensely satisfying. It makes sense even if the logistics don't. Universal acceptance of that one theory would revolutionize world history. Perhaps I just want to believe that we're all family. But here again, we have a theory consistent with the gospel message of love, hope, and charity, and with our own life experience that these things render life productive and joyful. I believe that any ordinances of any eternal meaning must be available to all mankind who have ever lived or ever will live. Anything less would be neither just nor merciful. Either the Mormon approach is right, or ordinances serve only earthly purposes. I believe I have spiritual confirmation that those ordinances are eternal. It's been suggested that Mormonism requires the trammeling of the human mind, the narrowing of our inquiries, the blind acceptance of doctrine and rules. I don't accept that. That view is not consistent with the whole of gospel teaching, with individual accountability, reward, and punishment. It's a convenient position for bureaucracies and those of a controlling bent. But I do not fear bureaucracy or my fellows. I fear God. We humans drink milk before meat, but we cannot sustain health on a lifetime diet of milk. And the hunt for meat takes us into the wild. I will confidently go on reading what I wish and contributing to forums and journals which herald the value of an honest and vigorous search for truth. I do not care how it appears to others, as God knows and I think blesses my motives. Also, I stay because I believe Joseph Smith was a prophet. No amount of genius or psychological deviance or alleged plagiarism explains the Book of Mormon for me. I don't even enjoy most of the book. It's militaristic and almost void of the female. I find it less than satisfying in many ways, just as I find the Bible flawed in many ways. I certainly see the hand of man in both. Both are confusing. Yet both set forth a complex, inspiring, and largely consistent religion. And what about Joseph himself? Well, he's flawed too, and some of his flaws were major. They fit nicely into my beliefs that not even prophets are without the capacity for serious error, and that God gives us a long rope with which to hang or save ourselves. Free agency is the most terrifying and reassuring of principles. Terrifying for our loneliness and responsibility, yet reassuring us that we matter, that life matters. But I'm not just a believer, I'm an active member. I once asked Lowell Banion why go to church when it's sometimes such a frustrating and unsatisfying experience. He said, to serve and bless, and to be served and blessed. That advice has helped me stay. Long ago, I stopped expecting church to be a place to learn history or theology, a place for an encompassing social life, a place to find social justice, or a place to shortcut the hard work of developing the knowledge and spiritual depth necessary to develop and sustain a testimony. I must find those on my own. No, church is just a place to serve and bless and to be served and blessed. Not often anything more, and that's okay. I have regrets. I wish it were otherwise. I'm sometimes thrilled to find it otherwise. But letting go of the expectation for more has allowed me to participate. So I stay, a doctrinal and spiritual Mormon, if not fully a cultural one. I stay to serve and bless, and to be served and blessed. I stay as I search for more truth, and the strength to live it. I hope in the process to become a better person.